Check 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 109, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Reinel with Peter Evers here inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. I'm Listening is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and we have a lot to talk about here on the program today. We're going to start first with what appears to be pretty much a clarity at this point in regards to what the governor is going to do with the budget. That's going to be to veto said budget, and we're going to discuss what that's going to mean, particularly for addiction and in the mental health aspect of things, and do kind of an upshot of the process as well. Peter, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Chris.
Good. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Your reaction to the governor vetoing the budget, and also kind of an explanation of what that means for providers and for individuals that are reliant on a new budget.
Yeah, I suppose I'm worried about it. I think the process has been a typically political one, and I'm certainly not going to indulge in picking sides here, but usually, you know, it comes down to bargaining chips, and it seems like one side, you know, I think there's been a lot of compromises, but we're stuck on the business tax issue. I think that's the one after the family medical,
family medical leave insurance
was negotiated. But what it means for us as providers, but more importantly, what it means for the people who are receiving these services is that we're going to be in limbo. And I think the 10-year mental health plan, which we've spoken about here, was really clear about not only the direction of building a system of care that meets people's needs, but the necessary funding for it is spelled out. And what's happening here is we've whittled away a lot of those of that funding. But I come to expect that. You know, you have big ideas to start with, and you end up with something. And I think we ended up with a Medicaid rate increase of 3.1% over 2 years, making it 6.2%. Not brilliant, because we haven't had an increase for 12 years, but it's something that we can put into our workforce. But if we get the veto, which it looks like we're going to go into a continuing resolution. We have to then rely on short-term funding, on last year's funding. And actually, for the mental health system, there's a worry that we got a temporary increase last year. That might go away. So we might actually be 8.5% behind what we had last year if that is not negotiated in a continuing resolution, which means a lot of problems for us in terms of making payroll. Because, you know, we have to raise wages and salaries because we have this workforce issue in the state. So I think people are really, really worried about the consequences of some sort of political sort of bartering back and forth that's resulted in a stalemate.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I talked about on my show on Tuesday, all the days kind of blending together at this point, this does not make a lot of sense from a political perspective for the governor. And I don't quite understand where he is going here. I understand you know, his feeling in regards to business taxes. The Democrats gave in on family medical leave insurance and took that out. The budget has a ton of stuff that he wanted in it. So to pick this one particular issue and potentially veto the budget over that creates such a, not just from a political perspective, but from, as you're referencing, a practical real life perspective, problems. And, you know, if I'm running for re-election, I want to run on the things that I was able to accomplish and the programs that I was able to push forth, the advancements that I've made on behalf of the state. You know, this creates a huge limbo where he may find himself, you know, you're going to have more say in regards to this. Other individuals, and this is just in one particular sector, there's a whole bunch of other different sectors as well within the state that are going to be affected by a veto of the budget. So why do I want to go into my reelect with all of these individuals angry? And you talking about not being able to make payroll, and that's a big statement that Riverbend may not be able to make payroll if the continuing resolution is not crafted in the way that it needs to be. and your organization is similar to many others. So, you know, he may say, well, it's he may try to cast the blame on the Democrats, but the fact of the matter is that the Democrats have pushed forth a budget here that the governor can work with, in my view.
Yeah. I guess I would say we'd have to go into a reserve is what I mean. Okay. In terms of making payroll. But I mean, but there'll be a shortfall. I don't get it either, Chris, because I think what it means is that if the business tax is not in there at that level, it means $90 million. I think people have done the math on that. And that's an interesting amount of money, because what we said we would do was we would fund these services that we haven't funded for years that actually meet the needs of vulnerable populations. And actually, it's, if you think about it, it's come down to a choice, really. Do I veto this so that I get the breaks for those few people who are doing well, or do I pass this budget so that we can get the services to people? We've been saying, and he has been saying, often he's been a great supporter of behavioral health issues, of substance use issues, or do we make that money available? And when you look at it like that, that's a difficult political position,
right,
to be in.
And I think that your statement there is one that is going to be used by Democrats. I would make the argument on his behalf that he sees it as an opportunity to create more jobs and to continue with growth of the New Hampshire economy, which will create more revenue and opportunities to fund programs moving forward. Basically, it comes down to an argument of a 0.2% increase, if you will, of the business tax. And you know, that's it's currently at the funding level of that was previous in the past year in 2018. The governor wants to what would be in the budget would be at the funding level, the taxation level of 2018, and I believe it's 7.9%. This current year is at 7.7%. Mm-hmm. So it would go back to where it was before, which obviously is in effect an increase. I think that the governor and Democrats should agree upon a set area where the business taxes are going to sit, say, for the next 10 years to create stability. If it's 7.7% versus 7.9%, do 7.8%. Mm-hmm. And say, we're going to do this for the next 10 years. This is how we're going to stabilize. This is what people are going to expect. Because Democrats look at the business taxes and see an opportunity where, this is just the business tax is just an ancillary effect. And it's not what's driving the economy. And if we raise the taxes a little bit more, it's not going to affect what business is doing business here, but it's going to create more revenue. Taylor Caswell, the Business Economic Affairs Commissioner, joined me on my show yesterday and said that basically a law had been passed that required the state to have their business taxes more in line with Massachusetts. And they're trying to get to that point. So I think that, I understand where the governor is coming from. I think that that business taxes are, it's important. I don't think that we should be picking winners and losers on the business tax front. If a business is coming from out of state to do business here or has a headquarters out of state, I want them to do business here in New Hampshire as well. So, raising the rate for those entities and saying, well, we're going to have a lower rate for businesses that are here in New Hampshire and that are homegrown.
Right.
I don't know if that is the best thing, but the fact of the matter is that a budget requires compromise. Mm-hmm. And Democrats have pushed forth a budget which includes a ton of stuff that the governor wants. Mm-hmm. And there's this one issue that he seems to be hung up on. I think, see if there can be some compromise on that particular issue, because going to a continuing resolution means the process also starts over again entirely. And, Senator Feltus has said he's going to put he's going to put family medical leave insurance back in, because this then becomes a winning political issue for Democrats that the governor vetoed the budget. And, I don't think this is the best move for him, both in terms of the services and reliability of the state of New Hampshire and its obligations that it has to meet, and also from a political perspective.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's interesting to see how it will work out, because at the end of the day, people are going to judge the governor on this. I was listening to Bernie Sanders this morning on the radio, and he wants to wipe out, what was it, $3 trillion of student debt. And I thought, wow, that's really pandering to a certain population. You know? And I can imagine if I had a whole bunch of debt, I'd vote for Bernie Sanders. On the other hand, how are you going to pay for that, and how do you offset that against all these other political issues? And that's the problem that he's in at the moment, and it seems to be shaping up that it's a governor's race between Senator Feltes and Governor Sununu, and is that really taking center stage here around political aspirations while we sort of flounder with a continuing resolution? And that's what I really worry about.
I agree. I mean, I think that it has become overly politicized and driven by personality as opposed to what's best for the people of the state of New Hampshire, which is, I think, a change from where Governor Sununu has been in the past. And we have seen that change taking place where he has embraced the president more, in my view.
Absolutely.
And he has become more Republican Governor Chris Sununu in this last year when he ran on and was past two elections and also governed, in my view, in his first term as more of an independent, a New Hampshire's governor, seeking to establish his own brand and identity. And to be quite honest, I thought the budget that he pushed forth was a really good one.
Yep.
And a lot of the ideas that he pushed forth in his budget plan, Democrats have in there. Perhaps some of the funding levels are higher and some of the priorities are different. But you know, for the most part, this is very similar to what the governor wanted, his focuses and the allocation of funding in order to address those focuses and priorities.
Yeah, it is confusing. But, you know, we're bracing for a veto, and I guess that and there won't be the votes to override that. And so, you know, that looks like the direction that we're going in.
That is Peter Evers. I am Chris Ryan. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 139, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. Tell us a little bit about our guests today and the middle segment of the show.
Yeah. We're going to have the Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative folks coming in, the Becky Whitley and Deli Champagne, who I've worked with a lot on kids' issues. And they're going to talk about Senate Bill 14, which is a piece of legislation that builds the system of care for children in behavioral health, but really right across all systems, justice involved, mental health, child protection, child welfare. And it's a really exciting time as long as we get that budget passed.
That is Peter Evers. I am Chris Ryan. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 139, 1450, nhtalkradio.com, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. We'll come back with our special guests after this. Let's do our wrap. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 139, 1450, and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. We're inside the Concord Photo Service Main Street studio. This hour of the show is presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health, and we have had an interesting show today discussing some of the problems that may take place if the governor vetoes the budget and how a continuing resolution will affect service providers and many entities, you know, across the state of New Hampshire. Creates a big challenge within state government as well for funding levels and how things are going to move forward. Contractors, their ability to work with the state of New Hampshire. So basically, you upset a lot of individuals when you veto the budget. And a lot of those individuals who are independents, really, are not partisans and don't have any political fight. Those individuals that decide elections and their families and you know, that's a group of individuals that you don't really want to upset. You don't care if you upset the Republicans or the Democrats too much, in my view. If you are, even though those are the individuals that are in your echo chamber or your opposition, but when you start to upset real average everyday folks and their neighbors and their friends and they're posting about it on Facebook and social media, that's where you start to create some difficulty. And with a governor that enjoys the popularity that Governor Sununu enjoys, you don't want to really tinker with the formula that's gotten you to this point. And this, you know, has the potential to be the first real move that he makes that is perhaps going to be unpopular across the board in New Hampshire.
And I couldn't agree more. And it doesn't seem like a judicious path for him to take. And you're right. And you know, just as we've been talking about, as we raise the issue, and this is just one issue of mental health and mental illness, and people talk more and more about it, there's more of a constituency there to say, yes, you know, my family has been affected by this disease. And if more and more people see that the political process isn't meeting the needs of those people, and there's more and more of us making those statements and sort of coming out and saying, yes, you know, mental illness is in my family, then they vote. People vote when they see that those services are under threat. So I think you're right, Chris. I think I'm not sure if this is the right direction that he should be going in.
As always, great to see you, and I look forward to talking again next week.
Thanks, Chris.
That is Peter Evers. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 109, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. For past episodes, you can go to our website, nhtalkradio.com, to listen to those. And we encourage you to have a great rest of the day, everybody. I'm Listening on 1039, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the program. We have an important conversation coming up where Peter is going to discuss some of the issues surrounding children and the legal system here in New Hampshire. He's going to be joined by Deli Champagne, who is the Community Engagement Coordinator, Hampshire Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative for New Futures. And he's going to introduce our guest. Go ahead, Peter.
Thank you very much, Chris. We also have in the studio this morning Becky Whitley, who is the policy director for the Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative. So, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, yes, and thank you. And thank you so much for getting up early and coming down to have a conversation with us on I'm Listening. So, I think it's always an appropriate time to have a conversation about kids, which is a statement that very few people would disagree with. But interestingly enough, in some ways, kids have been very much neglected in the process of behavioral health over the past decade, I would say, in New Hampshire. Interestingly enough, things got so bad after 2008 that there was a lawsuit filed, but children weren't involved in that at all. It's called the Community Behavioral Health Agreement, and really that was to say we're not providing enough services in the community for adults. But again, we didn't have a conversation about kids at that time. And last time I checked, children do actually grow up to be adults. And everything I think that we've learned over the years is that an ounce of prevention is really necessary in terms of warding off some of the difficulties that adults have later on, which is where you guys come in, right? I mean, I think in many ways there has been a void that you have stepped into in terms of advocacy for children and families, which has led, I think, to some great things that have happened over the past couple of years. And I know that you were both recently lauded by the, I think it was the National Association of Social Workers, right? As Citizens of the Year, is that right?
Yes.
See, I got a good memory.
Yes, thank you.
Well, and congratulations on that. But let's maybe talk a little bit. I made a bit of a provocative statement to begin with by saying children have been neglected. What do you think? Do you get that impression? Was that a void that you both felt that you needed to step into?
Peter, I have a son with a serious and persistent mental illness, as you know. He receives his services from Riverbend, and we're so thankful for the services he receives. But it was a struggle for many years, really, to get the school district on board, because there is a lack of understanding about behavioral health for children in many facets of our community. And we talk at the CBHC that a lot of these organizations that work with children work in silos. That's not good for our kids. So I used my lived experience to get this job at CBHC and use my advocacy skills and found other families that were feeling the same way. And we've elevated our voices and gone to the State House and said, we need change. And as a result of that, Senate Bill 14 was signed into law. And that's a piece of legislation that Becky and I are really proud of, and I'm sure she's going to talk more about that. But families 10, 15, 20 years ago, we really felt that void. We felt like our state was ignoring our children. And as you know, one in five has a mental illness. So we needed to be vocal.
Yeah, and in fact, when the state's last 10-year mental health plan was developed, now over 11 years ago, there was no mention of children. There was no mention of how to support children and families who are struggling with behavioral health needs. And so, in fact, the creation of the Children's Behavioral Health Collaborative was a direct result of that. People came together and said, you know, children have unique needs. We need to support children. We need to support families. And that's exactly why the collaborative came into existence. And in fact, you know, children have unique legal needs, too. And so in terms of the adult mental health lawsuit, children, in fact, have the state has more legal obligations when it comes to the state. And so, yeah, and I think one of the most important things that Deli does and that we try to do at the collaborative is bring, just as she said, to bring those families, those voices, those experiences to the state house. And that has been the most incredible experience this session, I have to say, to have those families be heard and be listened by people in power.
It's a really interesting disconnect, isn't it? Because, you know, everything that we learn in our culture, everything that that we see on television is this sort of, is this culture of nurturing, of babies. Everybody smiles when they see a baby, and you know, we're just so, and in some ways we're just sort of hardwired to feel like that. And I think that's a limbic response. That's something that we're born with. Where do we lose the plot here? Because I would have thought that pediatric care would be the number one issue. And I think just sort of answering a little bit my own question, I think sometimes we don't want to address issues of behavioral health in children because there's so much stigma attached to that. It's not like a child having any other illness. When we talk about Senate Bill 14, which we'll do in a minute, I think it's taken as read that we've pushed this issue under the carpet. We've brushed it under the carpet for so many years. I remember when I was working in Boston and I did emergency services and went to talk to the Commissioner of Education, Superintendent of Education at Boston Schools, and his chief of staff sort of yelled at me and said, you know, nothing is going to come between us and our desire to educate children, i.e., do kids leave their behavioral health issues at the door as they come into the classroom? Because that's how it sounded to me. And I said, well, I don't want you to do that either, but, you know, we need to treat children when they're in crisis. What is this about this disconnect?
I think what you identified, that sort of disconnect between the different systems, I think children don't exist in one system, right? Mm-hmm. We, you know, support children in schools. We support children in our, you know, the state systems that have set up to support children and families, but they just don't speak to each other. And I think we, you know, we can't look at sort of one system to address children. And mm-hmm. I think that is the beauty of Senate Bill 14, that it really, you know, that we have this vision of a true system of care with no silos, and SB 14 makes that next step to breaking down those silos, to making sure that children and families are getting support from the right system at the right time at the right place.
Peter, I think for me, my experience was folks looked at me as a bad parent. If my child was misbehaving, that was bad parenting. And I was trying to get people's attention and say, no, he really does have voices in his head telling him to do these things. And of course, he ended up being diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. But I couldn't get people to believe me. That was a very frustrating piece. And so I think that's part of it. I think we do judge families and we want to say, oh, that's bad parenting right there. But when in fact, there really could be something going on.
Yeah, and Deli, you know, you've done a lot of work in raising that conversation. I think it's incredibly important to have those conversations because I do think that parents who have a child with special needs tend to think that they're the only person who's going through that. They tend to think they are responsible. I think as human beings, we tend to think, well, it must be something to do with me, or something to do with my parenting. And that's very isolating, I would imagine. And that notion of bringing people together to have a similar conversation with similar experiences, I think is almost, is more important, actually, than the treatment piece of this for me.
Yeah, and I am so thankful for my second child that came along because He was so easy to parent. He was a top student. And I thought, okay, maybe this isn't me, because I started to believe that it was. Maybe this isn't me. I've got one kid that's turning out beautifully. He's so, you know, neurotypical. And so I started to believe in myself and realize there really is something serious going on here, and stop listening to, I remember one school psychologist that just made me feel so horrible about my parenting. And he said, you need a chart on your wall and you need to start giving gold stars to your son. This is what's going to fix him. You know, and I know.
That's a rather simplistic idea.
So frustrating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Becky, you mentioned before this sort of notion of siloed systems, and I was actually reading the other day about this new idea, which is really an old idea of relationships. And it was a talk actually given by an English person about the welfare system, and the American welfare system is built actually on the idea of the English one to some extent. And there was a report written in the 1930s that said we need to build these institutions that provide care. And what that did was automatically make systems that didn't speak to each other. And so what gets lost in that is that there's an upward facing desire to satisfy the system rather than a downward desire to create relationships in communities. And that, I mean, I knew that, but listening to the TED Talk was so interesting to me, because it meant, yes, that's what we've done. We've created the burden of paperwork, of reporting, but we haven't really taken a great deal of time to think about what those relationships mean. And I don't mean the relationship between the parent or the child and the provider. I mean the entire relationship. So talk about systems of care in Senate Bill 14.
Yeah, so and to build on what you were just saying, you know, also the way that we have structured the system in New Hampshire is sort of based on funding streams, right? And so, of course, in a resource-scarce state, you know, we are very much driven by funding streams. And so we have built our systems to support children and families around those funding streams. And I think now we're just really getting to have that conversation to start blending and braiding those resources to really just do what's best for children rather than, you know, how it's easiest to distribute those funds. So the collaborative was formed, you know, because of this history of leaving children out. But when folks did get together, they looked at other states, they looked at the evidence available, and they saw that the best way to really support children and families was through this framework called the system of care. And the system of care is a value-based system, but it's also very simple in that it basically says that children should get what they need, where they need it, and when they need it. And a big foundation of that is that, you know, children should be with their families, in the community, in their community schools. And so a big value of the system of care is that it's a community-based system.
So can I just ask you a question? Because I think you hit on basically the new future of healthcare when you said this is value-based. And I think that's a hugely important issue, because I think the health system in America has always been based on volume rather than value. So, and again, it goes back to those funding streams. The more sort of widgets that you make, the better pay you're going to have. And that's true in ordering an MRI, for instance, etc. But you hit on this idea of a value-based system. Does that mean that we're worried more about positive outcomes for families than the number of encounters that we've generated?
No, it means, when I say value-based, it means, you know, there are three core values: that the system is community-based, that it's youth and family-driven, and that it's culturally and linguistically competent. So that means that every decision that is made about the system is grounded in those values. It's not grounded in where the funding's coming from. It's not grounding in what organization it's leading. It's grounded in those values. And so if we stay true to those values, then it will move the system forward in a way that is consistent with the system of care.
Yeah, and I think it also interlocks very nicely with the triple aim in healthcare, which is, you know, quality, quality of outcome, satisfaction, and, you know, managed within a cost system, because everybody knows that the health system that we have at the moment is inefficient. But if we have those values, then we get to a place where people feel as though they're part of the system, and we're getting really good results, I think. So so what does this mean in terms of, where are we with Senate Bill 14 at the moment, and in terms of the progress? Is the money, has the money been voted on? Are we ready to release those funds?
Yeah, well, just to back up a little bit, Senate Bill 14 was really the result of years and years and years of work, even before Deli and I were there, to build the system of care. We do have an existing law, RSA 135F, that directs the state to build a system of care for children using those values and directs the system to break down those silos to better serve children and families. But recently, as last year, as a result of, you know, some really traumatic events that was happening, that were happening in the child protection system, there was an assessment that came out that basically said, you know, what you guys are doing in New Hampshire to build the system of care for children with behavioral health needs, you need to better connect the child welfare system to that system. So the child welfare system in New Hampshire is the child protection system, the juvenile justice system, that the DCYF system. And so what Senate Bill 14 does is a few things, but it implements the recommendations from that assessment to break down those silos, to better connect those systems, and also starts filling the gap for families in crisis. So the requirement of statewide mobile crisis for children and families. So the bill was fully bipartisan all along the way. We had wonderful support from both sides of the aisle. The governor signed the bill in early June, and at this point, we just need the funds. And so the budget that was recommended by the Committee of Conference fully funded SB 14. And all indications we have is that, you know, it continues to be work that is supported across the political spectrum. And so we are hopeful that in the end it will be fully funded.
Yeah, I know, it really is, fingers crossed. I know that these next few days are going to be sort of a little bit anxiety provoking for everybody around a possible veto and a continuing resolution, which never is a good thing for a sitting governor, I would say. It's something that should be avoided, and so I think I'm optimistic that it'll happen. Maybe it won't happen for a couple of months, but the work that you've done has been extraordinary in raising the conversation. And Deli, I think, you know, as we talk about raising the conversation, you and I have been involved in the campaign to change direction as well, which Chief Justice Broderick has been spearheading. And I think that's been moving us in a direction where we're just having a more open conversation about this disease. And I think the more that we talk about it in terms of it being a disease and not a choice, but also that its outcome measures are better than most other chronic diseases. Actually, CDC says that outcome measures for mental health treatment are better than diabetes, which is a similar pathway for a disease. Do you think those higher level of conversations have actually changed people's approach to having a conversation about mental illness?
Peter, you and I both know treatment works. I live with a child who's now 25, who, because of his treatment, is a productive adult today. So we know that treatment works. So we do need to talk about it so that people will seek treatment. I think elevating voices of young people is a good place to start. And I'm really proud of our Magnify Voices contest that we held this year. We asked students in middle and high school to submit a 2-minute video or a 1,000-word essay, anything behavioral health to them, anything that was bothering them or they saw in school, or we didn't limit the topic. And we crossed our fingers and said, gosh, we hope we get at least 40. Well, we ended up with 50, and they were so powerful. We got 26 videos, 24 writing pieces.
Can people see those videos?
They are on a website. It's called magnifyvoices.org. Children are, or young adults are, getting more comfortable having this discussion. And I thank John Broderick a lot for that, because he's been in so many schools and said it's okay to talk about this. So he kind of, you know, got us ready for this great contest. We're going to continue this contest every year, and hopefully this coming school year we'll get 100, and then next year we'll get 200, and we'll have so many we won't know what to do with them. But we would like to take them around the state and show them to people and say, this is what kids are saying. But I think you're right. I think the conversation needs to be elevated, and we need to destigmatize just something that's an illness, something that's a disease. We don't do this with any other illness. Right. Yeah.
You know, the other thing that I'm really encouraged about is the PM movement. I mean, and so certainly when 6 years ago we didn't have any peer support specialists, people with lived experience in the mm-hmm. workforce in at Riverbend. Now we have around about 40 of those folks. But the voice of kids and the support that kids can give to each other, I think, is the best sort of treatment for those kids. And some of the work that has been done in the schools around creating a place where people can have conversations, also creating safe language, creating a dialogue, is massively important. And I've seen some of the results of that in that, you know, we are normalizing. We are normalizing mental illness. And what I mean by that is that statement that an Australian psychiatrist said, that is really simple, and it goes, you know what? It's highly unusual for a human being to go through the lifespan without some episode of mental disruption or dysregulation or illness. Now, once you say that, you say, well, that's all of us, right? And once you, well, and once a bunch of kids are able to say, you know, I know what you I know how you're feeling, let's talk about it. It just becomes less isolating for that kid. And the more we can do that, the better, I think.
I couldn't agree with you more. Yeah, we need to elevate these voices.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, we are starting to also prioritize student wellness. So we know now our schools are understanding that for children to be ready to learn, for their brains to actually be ready to receive the information about how to read and write, they have to be healthy. And social and emotional well-being is a big part of being healthy. And so, you know, that really is sort of the next frontier, I think, for our work, is really working with school districts to make sure that students are healthy.
Do you find that, and maybe this is a little controversial, but, you know, I remember from the work that I did in Boston schools, you know, there's 170, I think, of schools in that region. And they all have a different opinion, and that opinion is often driven by the principal of that school. So, you know, and I remember being at, you did some work in juvenile detention as well, and I was sort of pushing this idea that we need to provide services in lockup for kids. And the superintendent said to me, yeah, well, you know, I got a dental problem. I said, okay, sure, you got it. But it's in the head, you know, and we should be treating all of those things. There's a real link between that. So we're making, I guess my point is that we're always prioritizing and reprioritizing. Do you find that there is a real difference in how the issues of behavioral health are prioritized in different schools? Is that something that we need to address on a statewide level?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think you're totally correct that it's really driven from the top down. What the school districts that have been able to, you know, implement this sort of framework to support student wellness, they've only been able to accomplish that with support from superintendents on down. But the way that they have been able to do that is with the use of data. So they've been able to show, if we fully support the behavioral health and wellness of students, you will get better test scores. If you support behavioral health and wellness of students, you will get less office referrals. You won't need to suspend and exclude kids as much. So, you know, that's a very powerful thing to share with school boards, to share with superintendents, that sort of that ounce of prevention will really help everyone.
Peter, we met with the Laconia School District the other day, and we learned that in one elementary school of 400 students, they had 2,700 office referrals in 1 year for 400 students. When they implemented this framework that we in New Hampshire, we call it multi-tiered systems of support for behavioral health and wellness. It's MTSSB is the acronym. When they instituted MTSSB, they started twiddling their thumbs saying, okay, what do we need something to do now? Because, yeah, they sat in their office and like, oh, gosh, this is different.
Yeah.
So it really works when you prioritize social-emotional learning.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Becky, just go back to what you said. I remember doing this work, and I suddenly realized I cannot go in to a school system and say I'm going to make all the kids well. I have to go in and say I got to make these kids MCAS scores, which was in Massachusetts, better. I have to do that. That's my job. My job is to work with the educational establishment where all of those schools are measured on educational outcomes, so that those educational outcomes are better. And those two things, of course, go, as you say, are absolutely braided together.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, you asked originally about state-level solutions. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of way we structure education in New Hampshire, you know, just doesn't support our children and doesn't support our local communities. And so, you know, there are scarce resources. And so school districts are left with, you know, limited resources, and they have to prioritize. But I guess sort of if we can get schools to prioritize student wellness, which in turn will support test scores, I think that's a big job.
Well, maybe the next thing, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. Maybe the next thing is to really force home this issue that regardless of where you live, you have a right to a good education and good health care. And we don't have that in this state. We don't have that in this country. And I think that's something that we really need to address next. So I've really enjoyed the last half an hour. Thank you so much for coming in. Maybe we'll have you guys back again when Senate Bill 14 gets fully funded.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks. This is I'm Listening here on KXL 109, 1450 and nhtalkradio.com, presented by Riverbend Community Mental Health. We'll come back and wrap things up after this.